Episode 25. When I was 25, I had the chance to hike to the top of Mount Kilimanjaro with my dad, which was one of the most memorable trips ever. Soon after the trip, we had our annual hockey pool, and my friends were concerned I may have suffered some anoxic brain injury on the mountain because my picks were abysmal. I came last place. But no matter, because in my 25th year, the Pittsburgh Penguins won their first ever Stanley Cup in the Sidney Crosby era, and it was also the year when the stock market began its vicious rally from its March 9, 2009 lows. Beyond MD, episode 25, here we go! Thank you so much for joining me again on Beyond MD. Today's topic is going to be holding companies, and for that, I have Ali Spinner back on the show. Ali is a tax specialist from Crowe Soberman. And if you remember, Ali, in fact, was my very first guest on my inaugural episode. So this is a bit of a trip down memory lane for me. So let me take a second to talk about holding companies. Very basically, what is a holding company? It's basically a company that holds your assets and then you can invest. This is different than our operating company. For many of us, that's going to be the medical professional corporation, which is what generates active income. The holding company does not generate active income. So my first exposure to holding companies came in 2020, and a bit of a story here. So January 2020, my sister reached out to me and she said, I'm looking for a rental. Will you come check out properties with me? And I said, sure, absolutely. So we started looking at condos, and then I started to scratch my head because in 2020, asset prices were cheaper and rents for condos were astronomical. And so I just thought, could the numbers actually work? So I started to look at different projects. I used buzzbuzzhome.com. At the time, I wasn't interested in a reno. I just wanted to get my feet wet. And so I thought, yes, the numbers probably would work to make it a worthwhile investment. So I talked to my wife, got her on board. You know, you have to be aligned on these issues. And then in February 2020, we made our first commitment to our first investment property, which is a pre-construction condo in downtown Toronto. And we've done one more since. But essentially, I think a lot of you know that I'm a believer in having a few buckets, so we decided it was as good a time as any to get our feet wet. We'll see how it goes. But I decided to go the holding company route for our first pre-construction condo investment. Why did I do that? Well, first of all, I wanted to use corporate dollars. So rather than pull the money out of the corporation to myself into my personal hands, which would generate tax, whether it be salary or dividend, I wanted to use the corporate money. So 88 cents on the dollar. And so I opened up a holding company, moved the money from the corporation into the holding company, and then used the holding company to acquire the condo. The second reason I was inclined to use a holding company was that I didn't really want to mix active income from medical practice with investing in a rental property and rental income. We're going to dive into more detail on this topic within the episode. And for anyone who is contemplating opening up a holding company, just remember it does not have to be a stressful or expensive experience. My experience was that it was one phone call, $550 later, and voila, the holding company was there. But as always, the most important question is why? Why am I doing this? For many people out there, a holding company may not be necessary, but for others, it may be helpful. So hopefully this episode will help to answer some of those questions. So Ali Spinner is a chartered accountant and partner in tax at Crowe Soberman. She has given numerous lectures and sits on many boards, and she has more than 20 years of experience in personal and corporate tax matters. And guys, I will say one thing. After my first episode, a lot of people did reach out and they commented on how useful they found Ali's perspective to be. She's very practical, very knowledgeable, and she always offers a perspective that I value. So hope you enjoy the interview. And without further delay, here's my conversation with Ali Spinner. All right, Ali, welcome back to Beyond MD. Where does a podcast find you today?
Oh, thank you so much for having me back. The podcast finds me today still in my home office. My home office located in Midtown Toronto, looking out into the sunshine on a cold wintry day.
Yeah, some things don't change. We're still working from home. But Ali, I'm really excited to have you back on because I can tell you your first episode of me, which was my inaugural episode, really well received. You're actually the most downloaded episode to date, and I think everyone's excited to hear from you again. So thanks for taking the time.
Very cool. I hope my passion for tax efficient planning comes through. I suspect it does, but that's great to know. And congratulations to you and all the success.
Hey, thanks, Ali. Your excitement always comes through, and I had to remind myself to caffeinate a little bit more just so I can keep up with you today. So I'm ready to go. And okay, so holding companies, Ali, this is a question mm-hmm. or a topic that comes up really, really frequently. So I thought it'd make for a great discussion today. So maybe just start really basic. What is a holding company?
Sure, that's a great question. And I think it is important to go back to basics, companies 101. So really, a holding company is simply an extension of when a medical practitioner, a doctor decides to incorporate in the first place. It's really just part of the puzzle of a medical practitioner leading a tax efficient life. So if we go back just quickly, why incorporate? In my opinion, there's two main reasons why you would incorporate. One is the opportunity to use tax deferral to create a large investment portfolio if you are earning more money than you need to live personally. And two, if there's liability that you're concerned that you cannot insure against, and it's important to have your business operations, your medical practice housed in a corporation. So once you've made the decision to incorporate, the decision will come up over time. Well, what about a holdco? What does a holdco mean? So one important piece to remember is that my understanding is that an MPC is not supposed to have another corporation as a shareholder. It's not one of the permitted types of shareholders. So it's important to note that in order to bring the holding company into existence, there's likely going to be a transaction where for a moment in time, there is going to be a holding company. That's a shareholder of the operating company. We can talk about the mechanism in a moment. But generally, of course, we all know, many medical practitioners that have a holding company, in order to facilitate the tax efficient movement of funds out of their MPC into the holdco for a moment in time. Sometimes we do it on a Saturday or Sunday when the medical practitioner isn't practicing. For a split second, there's the existence of a shareholding between the holdco and the MPC that disappears at the end of what I'll call the transaction. That's really how we get to the holding company. But really, there are three reasons why an incorporated medical doctor would want to use a holding company. As the MPC starts to build up cash and investments, you may not want to expose the investment assets you're building up in your corporation to the liabilities of the medical practice. That would be one reason to move cash out of the operating business into the holdco. Number two, there are some restrictions as to what the MPC can take on as activities. My understanding, again, this would have to be confirmed by a lawyer, but my understanding is that, the MPC may not be able to carry on a certain type of business, for example, and maybe that business is better housed in a holdco, which is separate from the MPC. And three, if you're a physician that is lucky enough to have a business that is saleable, that actually has value and somebody would want to come along and buy from you, then it's possible to sell your MPC, claim your capital gains exemption. And in order to do that, you would have to make sure that from a capital gains exemption planning point of view, your MPC is pure. When I say pure, that all of the assets are good assets used in the active operating business of the practice. And you would need an efficient way to strip out excess investment assets out of the MPC and put them into a holdco. I should just add, when I refer to holdco, we should think of holdco as simply a separate corporation other than the MPC. We could call it holdco. We could call it investment co. I mean the same thing, but it's not. It's just not the business. It's not the corporation, excuse me, that carries on the medical practice.
Perfect. So I think there, Ali, you essentially mentioned three big reasons why somebody may consider to have a holdco. I want to tackle them one by one. So the first one is protecting the assets from liability. And here's where I get a little bit confused, because a lot of us in medicine, we subscribe to the belief that we already pay for malpractice insurance through the CMPA. And part of this question may, in fact, be more for the CMPA, but our understanding has been that traditionally the CMPA has done a terrific job for its members if a lawsuit would happen. And so some people believe that, well, if I'm paying for malpractice insurance, why do I need to move my assets out of the operating company to a holding company? So I guess my big picture question is, how necessary is it to bring in this other layer into our business structure, the holdco, to protect our assets, practically speaking? Do you have a take on this?
I do have a take on it, and I think it's actually an excellent question. And I think sometimes medical practitioners or other people sometimes lose sight of the fact that, you know, we can insure away liability in certain circumstances. So I would agree with you. I would say it is a question for the insurer on the liability side. However, I wonder what other risks could be there. For example, if you had a medical office and someone came into the office and slipped and fell, presumably you have business insurance as well. But what if you didn't? Or what if the claim against the facility was in excess of that insurance? Who knows what? So that could be a reason why you would want to have additional protection. I completely hear you on the medical malpractice side. I think that the risks extend beyond simply the medical malpractice. I can certainly say that when I start to see doctors, you know, building up significant hundreds of thousands, million plus of assets in their corporations, there still gives me comfort that, you know what, let's separate this off. Who knows what the risk could be? I can't project what every risk could be, but I completely hear you on the medical malpractice side.
Okay. And then certainly some listeners are in dual professional households where there may be two medical professional corporations. So in that case, let's say you have spouse one and spouse two, and both of them want to start moving their assets out of the operating company into a holding company. In that scenario, when you have two corporations in the house, do you need two holding companies or can you do it all in one?
That's a great question. I would even argue, do you need two MPCs? Could you just have one professional corp that's owned by the two doctors? And it's funny because I think sometimes I think sometimes we forget that we could actually have one MPC for the two doctors, depending on their circumstances, how they're paid, liability concerns, of course. But I would say that it is possible that you could only need one holdco for two MPCs if you had two MPCs. There are various attribution rules in the Tax Act that are flying through my brain right now. We would have to take a review of those to make sure that nothing was offside. But it is definitely possible that you could have one investment co or hold co with two MPCs in the structure and not have the attribution rules that I'm thinking of apply. So it's definitely a possibility.
Okay. And then in terms of when one would want to consider a hold co for asset protection, is there a certain threshold of retained income that somebody typically hits in the operating company that would maybe trigger the thought, okay, now's the time for the hold co? Like, are there any guiding principles here? Or is it just more, if you have more money than you need?
A great question. I think that it still comes down to, I'm hesitant to say that there's, a minimum or a rule that we follow. It really comes down to what the liabilities are of that particular practice, again, beyond medical malpractice. And it also comes down to, well, what are the potential liabilities from the investments that you're investing in? For example, I would look at it differently from the MPC that's investing in a portfolio of stocks and bonds to one that is investing in real estate or other operating businesses. It really depends, because of course, then you could have a situation where if your medical practice is very valuable, you certainly wouldn't want liability from a different investment coming in to harm the protection of the medical practice. So it works both ways. I could say that when I start to see personally, my gut's telling me about $500,000 of investment assets or cash, it starts to make sense to me. It starts to be, worthwhile to spend the fees. Of course, there's going to be some professional fees to structure it properly. It starts to be worthwhile. I think another key point too is, and this is quite key, is that the maneuver I've referred to before, that there's this transaction or maneuver that we would use. The maneuver, which I'm happy to talk about in a moment, is much more cost-effective and straightforward to implement when we're dealing with cash than if we're dealing with an investment portfolio that has already begun to grow in value. Would it be okay if I explain the maneuver,
please,
if you will?
Please, that was going to be my next question. Yeah, let's do it.
So let's paint a picture in our minds. We have an MPC. They've built up $500,000 of cash. Nice round example, right? Round numbers. If the value is truly cash, and let's say that we have one shareholder who is the medical practitioner, effectively what we would do is we would have that medical practitioner incorporate a new co. This new co, hold co, investment co, all the same thing. I'm using it as a synonym. We would have them incorporate a new co. we would likely then also have the operating company. In this case, the operating company is the MPC. Mm-hmm. We would have the operating company likely declare what we call a high-low dividend to the doctor in their personal hands. That high-low mm-hmm. dividend means that dividend would have a fair market value of $500,000, but that dividend It would have a fair market value of $500,000, but mm-hmm. the dividend would be paid by the issuance of preferred high-low shares of the MPC. What that means, the preferred high-low shares means that they would have a fair market value of $500,000, but those shares would only have a paid-up capital of a nominal amount, say a dollar. Yep. So what would happen was the doctor then receives 500,000 preferred shares of their MPC. They have a fair market value of 500,000, but they have a paid up capital of a dollar. The reason that is important is that the deemed dividend that the doctor would actually pay personal tax on is only related to the paid up capital of the shares. Okay, so the doctor pays tax on a dollar, shouldn't be too much of an issue. The next step after we've created those preferred shares is that the doctor would roll those preferred shares to the NewCo. Mm-hmm. Using Section 85, as some people may be aware, using Section 85, and would take back as consideration from the NewCo additional share capital. Could be common shares, doesn't have to be anything fancy. Mm-hmm. But in effect, the doctor has now rolled the preferred shares of the MPC to the HoldCo and has taken back additional share consideration from the HoldCo. So this is the moment in time where I mentioned the HoldCo is now a shareholder of the MPC because the HoldCo now owns $500,000 worth, fair market value, of preferred shares of the MPC. So in the next moment thereafter, those shares between the HoldCo and the MPC are immediately redeemed. So those when I say that those shares are redeemed, the shares disappear. They are redeemed. The MPC, in effect, it's a legal term, buys the shares back, if you will, from the HoldCo. The shares disappear. And then, of course, on that redemption, we have to pay for the redemption. And the redemption here, the redemption proceeds are the $500,000, the fair market value of the shares. And this, in this circumstance, we would actually pay for that redemption using cash because we started off by having the cash on the books. So after the transaction is complete and the redemption is complete, we now have the doctor who owns two companies. They own their MPC. They own all of the shares of the MPC. And the MPC now has the value of the medical practice less the $500,000 of cash we just took off the books. And they now have a HoldCo that they are the sole shareholder of. And that HoldCo, the only asset is the $500,000 of cash that we've now taken off of the books of the MPC. And the beauty of this is that we are able to move the $500,000 of cash into another corporation without any income tax. If it came to light that we had to move investment assets, so for example, if it's a doctor who comes to me and says, oh, I've invested in this portfolio, it's grown, we could still do it. It would be a more complex transaction. We would still be able to do it on a tax-deferred basis. It would just be more professional fees. So that's why I just mentioned that it's easier to do it with cash, but that is effectively the transaction to move the cash tax-deferred basis out of the OpCo, out of the MPC, into the HoldCo or Investment Co.
That's really helpful, Ali. Thank you for that. So that tax-free movement of cash from the OpCo to the HoldCo, that's what's called the kind of inter-corporate tax-free dividend, right?
I would say that it's the intercorporate tax-free dividend on the redemption that allows the money to move from one to the other. We colloquially sometimes refer to the transaction as a roll and redeem strategy.
And now down the road, though, does the HoldCo eventually have to return those funds to the OpCo?
Oh, no. We've completely severed the tie. The beauty of this transaction is that in theory, if you didn't want to go through the transaction involving shares, what you could do is you could have the MPC simply make a loan of cash to the HoldCo. On the MPC's books, you would be exchanging asset for asset. You would be exchanging cash for a loan receivable. And on the books of the HoldCo, you would have a loan payable. And certainly you could invest the money in that way. The HoldCo would then invest the money and the growth would then belong to the HoldCo and not the MPC. But in that case, we haven't severed the tie. The HoldCo would always owe the $500,000 back to the MPC. That mm-hmm. may be a solution for some people as well, if they just wanted to do this using a loan. My preference, though, is that we want to cut the tie between the MPC and the holdco. Certainly, if we were doing this planning for purposes of capital gains exemption planning, where we mm-hmm. wanted to take all investment assets off of the books, we could not have that loan outstanding, because that loan owing from the MPC to the holdco would count as what I call a bad asset, and it would not allow us to claim the capital gains exemption.
Now, the capital gains exemption, I do want to talk about this a little bit more. Maybe, Ali, you can tell us what this is, what criteria sure. need to be met, and then most practically for the listeners, do medical professional corporations qualify for this?
So it's a great question. The bottom line is, it depends, but I'll explain why. But so let's talk about the capital gains exemption. The capital gains exemption is approximately a $900,000 benefit, and I'll explain that. When a person in Canada sells a business that qualifies, I'll use that term. So a person in Canada sells a qualifying business, or a qualifying corporation, I should say, mm-hmm. The first $900,000 of gain on those shares can be received by the vendor, the seller, in this case, the doctor, tax-free. It translates into a savings of capital gains tax of about $230,000, give or take.
Right.
So all things considered, in Canada, if you are a small business owner, including a doctor, if you're a small business owner that has value, I'll explain that in a moment, but if you're a small mm-hmm. business owner that has value, then certainly you would like to structure your affairs in a way that would allow you, upon the sale of your business, to claim the capital gains exemption, because who wouldn't like to save $230,000 upon the sale? So the question comes down to, do MPCs qualify? So the reason I said it's a great question, because it completely depends on the nature of the MPC's practice. If an MPC can create goodwill in its practice, if it has a value where someone else is willing to pay for that practice, then sure, I would say absolutely it can qualify. Do I see many typical MPCs generate that much value where they're being sold for millions and millions of dollars? Generally not. However, if you, it could be conceivable that you could build up a type of brand, for example, and have a clinic with a brand that creates goodwill and value. And forgive me, I'm probably not thinking of all of the different ways that physicians run their practices, but there certainly could be some practices that are more, that have more goodwill potential than others. Mm-hmm. It may depend also, for example, I'm thinking of family physicians. Sometimes I understand if they're in a faux, it may have a certain value. If they're in a different type of structure, it may have a different value. And I know also that as the government turns on and off the tap in allowing structures to exist, it can cause value or take away value. So the bottom line is that if you have a practice where someone is going to be willing to pay you, I'll call it a substantial amount of money, then it could be worthwhile to consider if you could structure it in such a way that the first $900,000 of value upon the mm-hmm. sale would be able to qualify using the capital gains exemption. I completely recognize that this won't be relevant for many, mm-hmm. maybe even most practitioners, depending on how they're structured, what their specialty is, how they're paid. But for some of them, it absolutely will. One thing that's really important, if we're going to talk about capital gains exemption planning, is that the benefit here, or the growth in value of the business, it's not growth that comes from the past earnings that you've made and the money that you've dammed up in the corporation, but have turned into investment assets. It really has to be related to what I'll call the goodwill or the air, you know, the brand mm-hmm. value, whatever you want to call it, within that business. The reason being that in order to qualify for the capital gains exemption, the company of which you are going to sell shares personally, the company at the time of sale must use at least 90% of its assets, including unrecorded goodwill. It must use 90% of its assets in active business. So that means that less than 10% of the assets have to be related to other things like excess cash or investments. Mm-hmm. So traditionally, you may have used me in the past used the term pure, we like to keep companies that ultimately will be sold where the capital gains exemption is going to be claimed pure, because mm-hmm. we know that we have to meet, and I do recognize I am oversimplifying this completely, but
no, this is good.
at the time of sale, at the time of sale, we have to meet this 90% test. One of the ways that allows us to meet this 90% test is to strip out excess cash in the way that we've talked about using this holdco strategy. So certainly this could be a benefit for a practitioner who would be able to sell their company down the road.
Back to the interview in just a minute. If you're new to the podcast, I want to say thank you for joining me. It means the world to me. For those of you who don't know me, my name is Yatin Chadha. You can also call me Yatin. Honestly, call me whatever you want. True story. I had an attending and clerkship in medical school who called me Yasshole for an entire day because he couldn't pronounce my name. But that's okay, because moments like that build character, they build resiliency, and they make for really good dinner time conversation. I'm a radiologist in Toronto with 6 years of clinical experience. I practice general radiology, but my passion is musculoskeletal imaging. Outside of medicine, I'm a proud father of two boys, a sports nut, and an avid golfer. So message me, get in touch if you want to play. I'm also an advocate for personal finance and financial literacy. I believe that good financial decisions involve common sense, having the right knowledge, and also starting on time. Now, back to the episode. All right, Ali, so that's a really helpful discussion on the capital gains exemption. Now, what about tax deferral and tax planning? One question I have is, let's say you've got the OpCo or the MPC and you've got a HoldCo, and let's say both of them have some passive investment income. So is the passive investment income between those two pooled and additive? And does that...
Absolutely.
And that's essentially what determines your eligibility for the small business deduction, right? So I just want to know if it's pooled.
Correct. It is pooled. And so it's not like there's a play to be able to take assets off of the books and put them into a HoldCo and then not count them for purposes of the investment asset, or I should say investment income pool for the small business deduction grind. So you're absolutely correct.
Now, we know that in the last 4 or 5 years or so, some new legislation kind of came in that limited how much we can kind of income sprinkle or split income. Does a HoldCo offer any additional benefits in that regard? I assume not, but I wanted to clarify this.
Great question. You're absolutely correct. So there would be no additional benefits that you could claim as a result of the HoldCo. We still cannot pay dividends to family members, to income split. None of that works. It's the exact same thing as using the MPC. The point, though, that I would say is that similar to the MPC, in retirement, it is likely possible to split income with your spouse. Mm-hmm. It would likely be possible to split income with your spouse on dividends coming out of the corporation at that time. For example, once we're over the age of 65, mm-hmm. if you end up with an investment corporation, it may be possible to freeze the doctor's shares of the HoldCo and allow the spouse to come in with a class of dividend sprinkling shares at that time, so that in a post-TOSI, post-65 world, we're able to extract dividends from the investment corporation on a tax-efficient basis between the two spouses. Now, truth be told, you don't need a HoldCo to do that. If you have an MPC and if you cease to carry on the practice of medicine in retirement and you no longer have an MPC, you would then just convert the corporation into being a regular corporation in retirement. You could still do the same transaction, freeze the value in the doctor's hands, allow the spouse to come in for a dividend sprinkling class and split income that way.
But I guess you're saying you don't necessarily need to rely on a HoldCo to do that.
Correct,
you could still do
correct.
It within your MPC.
Yes.
Are there then any kind of tax planning advantages that a HoldCo can offer? I one thing I've heard about is if you have more than one shareholder and you need to kind of plan when dividends are going to be distributed, can it help in that way at all?
Only in the post-65 world.
Gotcha.
In the post-65 world, because then we fall back into the world of TOSI and paying a high rate tax. My general comment is that no, there shouldn't be any additional tax breaks or benefits that you are able to benefit from The only one that comes to mind is if you are using it for capital gains exemption planning.
Gotcha.
Certainly, if you were going to have active spouses or children related into a new business that was going to be generated from capital, even then I'd have to be careful and read the TOSI rules very carefully. But we generally don't see people setting these up for some surprise tax benefit.
Now, one topic I did want to touch on, because I hear about corporate surplus stripping. And Ali, I'm just wondering if you can kind of help guide us here. One, if somebody is going, maybe just shed some light on the just basics of this strategy. And if one is going to consider pursuing this, is a holding company typically involved?
So that's a great question. And my view on corporate surplus stripping is likely not the same as everyone else's view on corporate surplus stripping. Or I should say, if you ask, if you put 10 tax planners in the room, you'll probably get 10 different answers. So my view on corporate surplus stripping is that, let's talk about what it is first. Let's talk about what it is. What it is when a person needs personal cash out of their business, what is the most efficient way to take the money out of the business? If the money comes out as a salary or dividend, then the doctor, in this case, is going to be paying the highest rates of tax, 53.5%, could even end up at 55% per se, depending on how the money comes out of the company. So often we get asked if there are more efficient ways to have the money come out of the business. One thing that people like to talk about is the ability to transmorgify what otherwise would be a dividend coming out of the business into a capital gain. We know that capital gains are only half taxable. And if you are able to structure funds coming out of the business and convert what otherwise could be a dividend into a capital gain, it is possible to save. It's not, sometimes people think about it as saving the difference between a dividend rate and a capital gain rate. And they think that the difference is quite large, you know, that it could be about, 25 points of tax or 20 points of tax. That's not quite true. At the end of the day, the savings, if you are able to successfully enter what I'll call a capital gain strip, is likely closer to between, let's say, 9 and 12, 13 points. Okay. So it's important to realize that the savings may not be as enormous as people perhaps think they are. But the benefit is, of course, that if you have a personal need for cash, you need to pull out $1 million from your corporation. Sure, anybody would love to save, 10 points and have an extra $100,000 that they could spend on their personal need. So the reason why I say that I may have a different view than others is that I do think that there is certainly a certain amount of risk involved in a capital strip transaction, or I should say there are varying levels of risk. One example that has no risk, which I think should be considered by all people who can incorporate, including medical practitioners, is that in a perfect world, the medical practitioner would earn money in their PC. They would pay, let's say in Ontario, 12.2% tax on the first $500,000 of profit, assuming that they can take advantage of the small business deduction. If they can't, then they're looking at paying 26.5% in Ontario, and then invest that money in a portfolio that is going to have significant appreciation, capital appreciation. Of course, if I could tell you what stocks to buy, I'd be a very wealthy woman, and I probably wouldn't be out here as a full-time tax planner, just teasing. But if the person can invest the money into a portfolio that grows in value, or any asset that grows in value, if you have assets that have appreciation, my advice always is liquidate the asset. The appreciation comes out of the corporation as a capital gain. So for example, You invest $100 into a stock. That stock grows from $100 into $900. There's an $800 gain in that stock. That $800 can now be extracted from the company at capital gains rates. That's the perfect example of a capital strip that involves no risk. All you've done, you've invested the $100, you've grown it to $900, you then liquidate the $900. and you're able to pull out the $800, not the original $100 that you invested, because that would still have to come out as a dividend, but the growth can come out as a capital gain. And I know many practitioners, or many business people, it extends beyond medical practitioners, who that is their path forward, is that they've gotten to the point where they've been able to create a beautiful investment portfolio, and they effectively live off the gains, and they're exactly back in the same best mm-hmm. position that they could be with any other type of capital gain strip, with no risk, absolutely no risk, no professional fees. No additional professional fees, I should say. It's a great situation. Now, of course, I recognize that, you know, practitioners starting out likely aren't in that situation. When I see people in the situation, they're likely, more than halfway through their career, if you will, and have been able to build up a large investment portfolio. So now, if we've talked about the no risk situation, let's talk about the other situations. So the situations that people sometimes look to do is that they look to capitalize really on the goodwill of the business. And it goes back to this concept of goodwill. If there is goodwill or appreciation of value within a business, then it may, and I use the term, I'm not saying for sure, but it may be possible to reorganize the business in such a way that allows for a prepayment of tax on that underlying goodwill or underlying appreciation of value that allows for the ultimate shareholder to be able to pull out cash from the business back at those capital gains rates. So I compare that to a situation where if we have a medical practitioner and they have no goodwill and they really are, I hope I'm saying this correctly, but they're really, I would go as far as saying, you know, a very well-paid employee. And again, I don't mean anything negative by that at all, other than, you know, you have a stream of income that comes in from the government. It's being housed in a corporation. You have the benefit to incorporate, but there's no goodwill. No one's ever going to pay you for that business. I truly struggle to find a way to structure a way of reorganizing the business where I could undertake a capital gain strip that would be free from enough risk that I would be comfortable to do that. And the reason I say that is that under the Income Tax Act, in the world of income tax and what the courts have opined on, you know, taxpayers are free to organize their affairs in a tax efficient manner. Where I perhaps would take issue, and again, I'm not here to give a full mm-hmm. General anti-avoidance rule analysis. Where I take issue, though, is that I think it would be pretty easy for the CRA to come in and argue that a transaction was really, I don't know if the term is, you know, a transaction of convenience or whatever it is that we're doing. If there's no fundamental business reason for a transaction, I think that the risk rises. Mm-hmm. And I sometimes am concerned because I hear from a lot of medical practitioners saying like, oh, you know, this person told me to do this, this person told me to do that. And I question if everyone is being made aware of the risks that are associated with a mm-hmm. transaction. And the risk, I think, in this case, it could go beyond just the cost of non-deductible interest and the cost of the professional fees. I would actually worry that there could be double tax. Not to say that everyone should be concerned and all that good stuff. I would just say that if you are going to enter into a capital surplus stripping transaction where you are converting what would otherwise be a dividend withdrawal from the corporation into a capital gain, mm-hmm. You have to be aware of the risk of what you're doing and how you're structuring it. Certainly when I structure them, I look to, you know, I look to the structure where we have a true business need to restructure the business, and the capital strip is really a byproduct of the transaction as opposed to the intention. So, you know, back to the beginning, there's a real easy way. I had, for example, a wonderful call with a physician a couple of weeks ago, and he was calling me about capital strips. And I gave him my caveat of, look, I really don't think that I would be comfortable doing this for you. And then I said, well, wait a minute, what's in your holdco anyway? And lo and behold, it was that exact situation of he had an investment portfolio with a $100,000 cost, a $900,000 value amount. And wow. I looked at him and I said, yeah. I said, what are you calling me for? I can't believe we're having this conversation. Just sell the portfolio. He was going to take out the cash anyway. I said, sell the portfolio, pull out the cash. That $800,000 gain comes out at capital rates. we don't even need to talk about this. And yeah, I not that I want to say he felt a bit silly, but it was pretty funny that that's where we came to at the end of the day, is that he had the natural capital gain strip, if you will, in his structure to begin with.
Ali, I love the answer and I really appreciate your honesty. So just speaking of investing, so are you then of the mindset that a medical practitioner who is incorporated should typically be investing through the holdco rather than the opco to just separate investments from the operating company in medical affairs?
I certainly think that is my preference. Again, if it doesn't have to be, that's certainly my preference. And when I start to see physicians building up, again, it's probably around that $500,000 level, I like to start moving the money out. It gives me comfort. Not that I'm the most conservative accountant at all, but I want to make sure that people, we eliminate risk wherever we can.
Fair enough. No, I think it's something I may have to give some thought to down the road. But in terms of eligible investments within the holdco, I do have some people who ask me, well, I love cars, I love watches. Can I invest in collectible items inside a holdco? What's reasonable here?
That's a great question. So the bottom line is you can really invest in whatever you want. There's actually no limitation. The thing that's really important is that if you're investing in watches because you like to wear them and it's a personal asset, then I would say absolutely not, because we have to remember we have to be careful. We should not be using corporate assets for personal use. So if we're going to have a watch collection that sits in a case and you're truly a collector and these aren't watches that you're wearing, sure, go right for it. But if these are, you know, if you have a thing for shiny things and you like to wear them and it's for personal use, don't do it. Because effectively all that you're doing is you're using corporate dollars for personal benefit. And the risk there is double taxation. Not even that the government could come in and say, oh, this should have been a dividend to you, let's treat it like a dividend. Dividend would not be double taxation. They could come in with what's called a 15-1 benefit, which is double taxation, where they would hit the shareholder with a personal benefit and there's no offsetting deduction or consideration of the tax that the company's already paid. So, and that speaks to, if you're going to, that's why we don't buy personal homes or personal cottages or, you know, personal boats, that type of stuff. It's no different. If you're a collector, go for it. If you're a collector that's my answer.
That's very practical. What about rental properties? We often kind of juggle, where do we hold these rental properties? Should we own it personally? Should we actually go out and buy it through our OPCO, the Medical Professional Corporation, or should we use a holding company? Do you have a stance here?
Sure, I definitely have a stance. So certainly, if you are going to finance any investment using funds that have been generated by the business, by the medical the MPC, certainly you want to make the investment at the corporate level. The reason being, I guess it's twofold. One, to fund the initial investment, you're going to have more dollars. Use pre-tax dollars or pre-personal tax dollars to make the investment. And two, if you are going to have to finance, you know, typical with a real estate acquisition for investment purposes, you know, you put money down and you often enter into a mortgage. If you're going to enter into any external financing, then you want to also be able to pay off that external financing using active dollars that have only been subject to the, you know, 12.2 or 26.5 rate of tax as opposed to personal rates. So yes, I would say use corporate dollars to fund it. I would not put a real estate investment asset into an MPC. I wouldn't. I think that there's too much, you know, cross risk from the two to taint each other in the case of a claim. I would certainly put it into a holdco, and I would think that could be it's a great investment, just like buying any other investment could be. Sure.
Back to asset protection. Let's say you invest in a rental property through the holdco. Something happens. The tenant tries to sue you. What happens to the assets in the holdco? Are you protected, or can they actually seize those assets? This is a question that comes up all the time.
It's a great question. Again, it's a legal question. I'll have to be careful on how I answer it. I am not a lawyer, but my recommendation or my comment would be is that the assets within that corporation certainly appear to me to be fair game, which is why I do not want, if your NPC has value, I do not want your NPC in that corporation. And typically when we see clients, enter into significant real estate transactions, it is not unusual to see a separate corporation used for each. Now, that being said, again, I go back to what we talked about at the beginning, whereby certain liabilities can be insured away. And certainly I've had people who own real estate who've had no concern because they felt that they had the appropriate, you know, landlord policy or ownership of land, whatever it is, policy in place so that it there wouldn't be an issue. But certainly I would think that if a claim was made, that the assets within that holding corporation or investment corporation would be at risk.
Are there any magical pearls related to holdcos that we haven't covered today? Because last time you blew my mind with the corporations, because I did not know about the benefits of charitable gifting. And
for
I
sure.
was kind of speechless when you first mentioned it. Anything related to the
No, but I would add that the charitable gifting could also be used in the corporation where, again, you could, I am passionate about planning for philanthropy. You could get that triple benefit again in the corporation of not having to pay tax on the gain, getting a full donation receipt and creating capital dividend account for the shareholder. Same thing as with the MPC. I'm trying to think if there's anything else that comes to mind. There really isn't. I really see it as an extension of the decision to incorporate in the first place and a vehicle to use to keep your MPC pure, both from a capital gains exemption piece, if you are lucky enough to be able to take advantage of that, as well as just from an overall risk piece.
Okay, perfect. And then just for balanced discussion, any disadvantages to holding or to opening up a holding company that we should be aware of?
No, that's important. I would say, so, you know, first of all, in order to open it and go through the roll and redeem transaction that I discussed before, there are definitely going to be accounting fees and legal fees. It shouldn't be cost prohibitive, but there definitely will be fees to open it up. And there's going to be ongoing fees to, you know, have an accountant prepare a financial statement and corporation for a second company. Now, keeping in mind, you know, any bookkeeping for the investment portfolio would have been required wherever the investment portfolio was. But yes, you will have to pay some additional fees for a second filing, if you will. Again, it shouldn't be cost prohibitive, but it will add a little bit of complexity to the structure for sure, and a little bit of increased fees.
Okay, Ali, listen, I love your passion for tax. And I was really excited when you told me that holdcos are your jam. It's been just a pleasure. Yeah, seriously, it's been so much fun to connect with you. And I try to, in these episodes, just sit back and listen to you talk because I'm learning a lot. So Ali, thank you again for your time.
With pleasure.
Okay, there it is, holding companies. So let's wrap it up with a few points as to why one may consider opening up a holding company. Number one would be to separate investments and assets from any medical liability risk that would come with your medical practice. Number two, to purify the medical professional corporation for access to the lifetime capital gains exemption. And this would typically only apply if you have a saleable component of your medical practice. Number three, maybe you're embarking on a business venture and you want to avoid any cross risk between that venture and your medical practice. Number four, real estate investing. There are many of us who use this strategy, but most importantly, remember, there is no financial advice on this podcast, and we are not telling everybody to run out and go open up a holding company, but rather we hope that we've given you some considerations for whether or not a holding company can fit into your small business structure and whether or not it can help you to invest your money. So please keep reaching out with questions, feedback, and topic suggestions. I love it. Thank you so much. I'll see you in about 3 weeks' time with my next solo episode. Reach out to me either LinkedIn or beyondmdpodcast@gmail.com, and we'll see you soon. Stay well and stay savvy.